Yeah, you can always tell. I don't know if we're ready, but you can always tell when an audience is ready. So we better be ready. Welcome, everybody. I'm Drew Altman. I could tell you that things are so crazy in Washington right now that we actually felt it took the combined powers of Kaiser and Harvard and Robert Wood Johnson to do this survey this time, and the unequaled experience of Julie Robner and Jackie Combs and David Wessel to tell us what it actually says. And still we feel inadequate to the task. But the truth is, for those of you who have followed this project for a long time will know this, that this is one that we traditionally do with Bob, with Bob Blendon. And if you can follow this bouncing ball, so Bob was the founding senior vice president of Robert Wood Johnson in 1972, and I was a VP there for 6 years with Bob, and I want to underscore sharply that was not in 1972. And Molly worked with Bob at Harvard before coming to Kaiser, and so ably leading our polling work for so long. And everybody in health policy has been working with David Colby absolutely forever. So you could conclude from that, A, you should have even more confidence in this project than ever before because the team has worked together for so long, or B, health policy research is even more incestuous than you ever dreamed. I could do that as a polling question. Thinking about this project, would you say A or would you say B? I think the answer is B. As you know, when you come to these things, I usually do a short introduction, and that's what I'm going to do today. I just want to make a couple of points, and then we'll get to the poll itself. First of all, to repeat something I like to say every time we do these, from Kaiser's perspective, we do this survey, we really do all of our polling, not because we believe that policymakers should do what people say they should do in any one poll, but because we believe opinion is an important factor in the policy process. It is an important factor in the policy process, and that it's critical to understand what the public thinks, as well as what the public knows and what the public believes, which also shapes what they think. We're also big believers in the importance of rigorous independent polling, as well as polling that can go deeper on policy issues, which, as you may have noticed, is really our specialty at Kaiser. So, you know, we're likely to ask people, what are your views on federal matching rates for SLIMBYs and QIMBYs? No, we would not ask that question. But we do push the limits of policy polling. And we do some of that in this poll as well. Lately, almost everything we poll about in health policy has a partisan overlay. We could ask people about their views on health on Pluto, and I think we would see sharp differences between Republicans and Democrats. The Democrats are for better health care on Pluto, and the Republicans are against it. That was one reason why the finding on exchanges really jumped out at me, because our polling on the ACA has been divided sharply along partisan lines since the beginning of time, since before the law passed, really, in truth, since the Clinton health reform debate, but since the law has passed, and it hasn't changed much. The governors largely divide along partisan lines on their plans for exchanges and Medicaid expansion. So it just stood out that there was clear bipartisan support among residents in states to set up exchanges in their own states. That was the question that we asked. And, you know, if you just step back from the polling for a second and think about it from a health policy perspective, that kind of makes sense, because what are exchanges? Exchanges are regulated competitive marketplaces for private insurance that will expand coverage largely by doing what? By offering mostly high-deductible plans with government subsidies for lower and moderate-income people. So in that stew are a lot of things that both people on the left and people on the right can like. But reason has seldom, you know, eclipsed ideology in the fight over the ACA, because the ACA has just become a symbol of the larger ideological and partisan divide in the country. That may change as we get from where we are to the ACA becoming a reality for people after 2014. It may not change so much. That's why we will keep doing polling, and we will track that. We also continue to see more support for Medicaid across a broad range of questions in our polling and in this poll than the inside policy debate about Medicaid would lead you to expect to see. We found support for state regulation to control health insurance premium increases. I mentioned those because those are both topics which are very much in the news lately, and I imagine we'll be talking about that as we get to the findings. And then just finally from me, just one comment about the findings on reducing the deficit. It's really not new that people prefer a balanced approach, that they'd rather see the rich pay more, that they don't like cuts to Medicare much to reduce the deficit. I mean, people were not sitting around waiting for us to do this poll to finally tell us that for all their lives they've been waiting to give up their Social Security and Medicare benefits. So, you know, we didn't find that in this poll. But what was sharply highlighted in this survey is that people start from a different basic understanding than policymakers. And that is a problem if there's to be a public understanding and public support for whatever comes out of Washington in the next several months. So policymakers that Medicare must be cut to reduce the deficit, and then the debate is about how much and, you know, how and in what ways, and people actually very different, that the deficit can be reduced really without cutting Medicare much or if at all and without any real sacrifices from them. And that does not mean that people would become valiant self-sacrificers if they looked at Medicare the way that policymakers do, but a common basic understanding of the problem certainly would help the debate. It would limit the kind of exploitation of the Medicare issue that we always see when there are debates about Medicare. But we don't have one, a common understanding of the issue between policymakers and the general public. And that also jumped out at me in the poll. So that's my little introduction. As you know, I always do one. Our plan for the day, Molly Ann and Bob will summarize the main findings from the survey, and then Dr. David Colby, who's RWJ's highly respected VP for policy, who I first met when he worked on the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. He knows so much about all the issues that we'll be talking about today. David will add his perspective on the poll findings. Then we will take a few questions, and then we'll switch to our panel, and Jackie and David and Julie will give us their take on the results. But beyond the results and beyond the poll, also, I'm anxious just to hear their take on how they see things unfolding over the next several months, generally in the budget and deficit reduction debate, and in healthcare as well. So, Molly.
Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. As Drew just mentioned, Bob and I are going to lay out the findings and just make sure that it's sort of that you have a basis for what we found in this poll. You have in your packet a chart pack, and if you want, you can follow along that way or by looking up in any of the screens. So, you know, given that the implementation of the Affordable Care Act requires such a great deal of state action on everything from establishing the exchanges to expanding the Medicaid program, we thought we'd start this year with the public's views on health policy in the state. And so what you see here in chart one is that we gave people a list of potential things that their governor and state legislatures could work on in the health policy arena. And we asked whether they thought this should be a top priority, an important but lower priority, or not important at all. And note, right there at the top, that more than half said creating health insurance exchanges or marketplaces should be a top priority. That's the dark blue part of that top bar. Now, Drew already mentioned this finding, and I'm going to say a bit more about it in a minute. But I think you should also notice on the chart that about 4 in 10 said the same thing about supporting women's access to reproductive health services, increasing state regulation of health insurance premiums, and about 3 in 10 said increasing regulation of charges by providers or expanding the Medicaid program or fighting obesity should be top priorities for the state policymaker. Now, If you look at chart two, it shows the same question, but it shows the share that name each a top priority by people's political party identification. And you see right there at the top that 60% of Dems and 55% of Republicans agree that we should create exchanges and marketplaces and that this should be a top priority. So any of you who have been following any health policy in any polling on health policy for the past 3 or 4 years, and certainly with Drew's example of Pluto, knows this is a pretty rare bipartisanship finding. It is a real rare event that we see such agreement on anything in this arena. And I guess the question is, what should we take away from that? And I guess I would take away that clearly the implementation of some provisions of the ACA, if they could be depoliticized, you would start seeing more agreement out there in America on how to transform the healthcare system. Now, note that we did not tie this idea of exchanges directly to Obamacare. I can tell you without even testing that, that that would be a sour reaction for Republicans, because anything tied to Obamacare elicits a sour reaction. Furthermore, we use the term exchanges or marketplaces. And no one is against the idea of these competitive marketplaces, particularly not a Republican. And I think you probably all saw the news this week that exchanges have been rebranded. And guess what they've been rebranded to? Marketplaces. So it's not a surprise, in a sense, that this is an idea that actually does garner bipartisan support. So I think the take-home point is that, that this gets more support across all political persuasions than any other health policy priority at the state or national level at this point. And certainly those who are interested in establishing these exchanges can use that and take advantage of that factor in their marketing and in their messaging and framing. Now, I also would like you to look a little bit further down on this chart and note that expanding Medicaid does not share the same bipartisan support that we just saw for expanding for establishing exchanges. About 2.5%, 2.5 times more Democrats than Republicans name it as a top priority. And as we turn to charts 3 through 8, we're going to get a little more in-depth understanding of how people think about this Medicaid expansion in the ACA. So you see here on chart 3 that when we give people more information about the provision and what it would actually mean, we find that more, 52%, that's the orange part of the top bar, favor the expansion than the 42%, the blue part, who prefer to keep Medicaid as it is today. Now, what the rest of the bars show is that same party division that we saw above in terms of the priority for the state actors. Dems want expansion, Republicans don't. And in chart 4 and then again in 5, you'll see the results of what happened when we read supporters and opponents of expansion arguments that are made by each side with the goal of trying to get a better feel for how malleable opinion is on this issue. And in general, as you see here and here, when we asked, when we see that arguments in favor of expansion can move about 11, 12% of people to become supporters. On the other hand, arguments that are for those who originally supported it, about 14% could be moved to be in opposition. So what I'd say is that opinion is somewhat malleable on this, and it means that state policymakers have some room to try to move people on the topic with their framing and their messaging. But perhaps what's most important is what we show in chart 6 and 7. And here it shows that the majority of the public considers both Medicare and Medicaid important programs to their families. About half of both Dems and Republicans say that Medicaid is working well in their state. And furthermore, in chart 8, we see how much more true this is for people who are in low-income households. So I think these findings help explain what we're going to see in a minute. That's that the public has a strong preference for the status quo in these programs and a great reluctance to see them cut for any deficit or budgetary purpose. And now, finally, on this broad question of the public's views of implementation, note that in chart 9, we find that the strong partisan divides that we have seen since day one of this debate, they continue today. More, 52%, think that those who are opposed to healthcare law should continue their efforts to try to change or stop it, while 4 in 10 think that opponents should just accept it as the law of the land and stop trying to block it. but note again how strongly the Democrats and the Republicans disagree on this. It looks almost identical to the divisions that we have been seeing in our tracking surveys of favorability of the ACA every month for the past 3 years. So I think the bottom line is that while the Supreme Court decision and certainly the re-election of President Obama certainly answered resoundingly the question about whether the ACA was going to be outright repealed, I think what we will continue to see and hear is heated policy debates at both the state and the federal level as implementation continues. And I think you need to remember that at least part of that rancorous and contentious debates reflect these divisions among the public. So I want to turn now to a topic that has certainly been and will continue to be front and center in the political and policy arenas, and this is the budget and the deficit debates. In particular, in this survey, we wanted to explore the role the public saw for the large health care programs, Medicare and Medicaid, in the context of the budget debate. So I'm going to take the next set of slides together from charts 10 to about 15. And overall, we find a familiar conundrum facing policymakers. The public expresses a general sense of urgency about addressing the nation's budget deficit, but at the same time resists any proposal to change the nation's largest entitlement programs or to make any sacrifices themselves in the form of higher taxes or fewer services. So here in chart 10, note the large agreement that the deficit is a problem to tackle and we should be tackling it now. While in chart 11, you see the familiar partisan divides again on views on how to best tackle it, whether it's raising taxes or cutting spending. Now, in 12 and 13, we see, as Drew mentioned before, that really it's only raising taxes on the rich that we get a sort of a popular response, although you see some tepid support for making corporations pay more and limiting deductions. But in chart 14 and 15, and I'm going to start here with 14, I think you really see the crux of the challenge for those who want to see spending cuts as any part of the deficit reduction plan. The public does not want to see much of anything cut. So blue says, don't cut me. Gray says, maybe a little bit. And the orange says, go ahead, cut. Now, look particularly at public education, Medicare, and Social Security. This is large majorities who are saying, please don't touch these programs. And here on chart 15, you see that this is something that the political partisans can agree upon. So with this as context, I'm going to turn over to Bob to talk more about the potential changes to the Medicare program and the public's general reluctance to see that program touched for any particular means of budget deficit reduction. Bob?
Hi, Bob Lennon. After all these years, you try to make some contribution here. And I want to make an overall point and then that just corresponds with Molly. We have here with Medicare the largest gap between the expert inside Washington group than I have probably measured in my career. And that is the people we're surveying think you should close probably 8 to 10 of the major cabinet offices before you ever get to cutting this program. Every meeting I go to, it's let's get it on the table and start working. So in looking at polling data, you need two variables. It isn't that there's this huge difference. It is that they care about it. And that's what I think our role is to alert you. You have 54% of people who think this thing is very important in their lives. So when the gap between what all the expert community and I live in that wants to do and they figure out what you're finally doing, there's going to be a huge political backlash. So we have 8 tables and 5 slides, but you have to understand this. Our only contribution, this is a weather forecast. When you get in the middle of this, some of you are going to email Molly, wow, this is a lot worse than I thought it was going to be, as we have a real gap. Also, I, along with every one of you, go to meetings would say we cannot keep traditional Medicare as it is. We just have to redo it. This was a terrible error. This is a 1950s program and the whole new century. As the next slide shows you, that only is fine for anybody unless they're in an age range near the program. And those who are think it kind of works okay. So this is not the audience for the French Revolution in Medicare. I just want to alert you to that. And this is Molly's point again, and this is an incredible gap. Can you reduce the deficit without reducing Medicare? And people say yes. And I live on a floor with 11 economists, all of whom start out by saying, you can't possibly even discuss this issue unless you do it. So that we just have a huge gap. It's going to play out politically. You'll call Molly back in 2014 and say, now, what did that slide say again? Because some of the discussions are going to be very hard for people to deal with. To no surprise, what would people change? Anything that has to do with purchasing anything. People are willing to see reductions, and so pharmaceuticals are at the top, and that would be it. At the bottom is you're really going to make everybody on Medicare pay higher premiums, and that's where this plays out. The one that's gotten the most attention, and it's sort of divided evenly, is raising the retirement age. And so people have their usual chuckle. Those who have retired are somewhat more willing to take the tough steps for that. The next slide just says that on this debate about retirement, there is a little softness with, depending on the argument, you're going to save the program on one side. You go, oh, maybe I should do that. And on the other, it's really going to hurt a lot of people and throwing businesses for that. So there will be a debate, but all in all, there's a lot of ambivalence here about what is the most popular option that's there. As Molly mentioned, and those of us who've been through the deficit polling, anything that raises taxes on the top 2% is popular like ice cream. So you just put it in there, raise up, okay. So that's where it is. The thing that's a bit of a shocker for my policy colleagues are that actually this has been going on for quite a while and nobody knows it. That was a real take back because we have how far can you push it, how much money can you save, where is enough. But the first level is, did you ever do it? A lot of people missed that night when that agreement was done. One of the things that we're pleased about is in these budget debates, everybody gets completely absorbed with basically the big government insurance programs and doesn't ask about the rest of what health is. For that. So we did take sort of 15 programs, and we told them five times there's a deficit. We're only reporting on the top priorities. They've been through. There's not enough money. But it's just important to know that there are five that even in this awful fiscal climate, people really feel strongly about government spending continuing, and that is support for veterans' health care, preparedness for natural disasters or terrorist attacks, and we are guilty. It followed Sandy. I cannot tell a lie. It did. For that, and prevention for infectious diseases and chronic illnesses. And we did a quick run, and one of the things that's just interesting is if I think that prevention actually saves money in the future, I am on that top 50%. So what happens is that to the degree there is a division, it's a belief whether or not if I invest in this, it really is going to have a payoff. They are the top five after we really told them so many times we're running out of money, everything's going to go, it still hangs in there. And so here you see the improving, spending the money improves health. So we've made some impact in prevention because years ago, this was not a winner. People just didn't have much of a link with where it is. A few of us were discussing this ahead of time. Usually when you ask people what the top issue in the healthcare system is, you usually get costs. And at the moment, it's sort of interesting. It's sort of split between costs, access, and no government. So that's kind of new to the open-ended questions, the no government side. So you see the tensions that are going on within in the healthcare field. And we sort of just wanted to do this at the end for a second. Every platform that we all appear on, people start out by saying the word, we have to fix the healthcare system. And they neglect to say, who is the we? So we said, if you heard, we was the government. How do you feel about that? And it's important to notice Drew's issue about polarization. So you have 67% of Democrats thinking that the federal government should play a major role in fixing health care. And I have to put my glasses on, but it is 14% of Republicans who share those values. And on the state side, and that is a big change, it used to be switch over the word state and Republicans and Democrats can hold hands together. No longer. You insert the word government, it doesn't matter at the moment. And so, again, the majority of Democrats favor state government playing a major role, but not Republicans. So this is when you're looking at the states that are holding out and why are they ideologically and why are they still fighting the battle that Molly talked about over again, there still is this resistance and two different views of how much government should play here. And so let me just quickly close with a question which is asked about what are the big health threats that really worry Americans. A little bit of this series goes back to the 1940s. Cancer was the top in the 1940s and has been there. What there has been a big change since 2007 is the huge rise of public concern around obesity and diabetes. This was something, as you could see, that was not very high on the American agenda, and there has been a huge shift in 5 years and likely to change continually the discourse about what's important, something that would not have been here 3 or 4 years ago if we were discussing where we go. Quit that sort of our snapshot picture.
You know, it's interesting. I'll tell you a secret of the poll. Unlike previous years, just because of travel schedules, the three of us did not really rehearse or discuss what our top-level conclusions were. But they were exactly the same, which is one interesting. Sometimes we disagree, and two gives me some confidence that they're the right ones, especially about this gap between the public and policymakers and experts about the problem and about some of the solutions. So let's see if David sees it totally differently, or also looks at it somewhat the same way.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the nice comments, Drew. You know, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, when Bob came to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, was worried about health insurance expansion and how we could support health insurance expansion. And that was the expansion that was being proposed by Richard Nixon. So that has been a...
I was a child back then. Really
yeah, Bob was 12. And we've had a long history in health insurance issues. I want to thank Molly and Bob for really laying out the findings. These are very revealing. I'm going to do what a good jazz fan does, and I'm going to riff on this and take up three themes and talk about three themes. And I'll tell you, I mean, I have on my iPod, I have 15 versions of Bye Bye Blackbird, probably 12 of them by Miles Davis. And I always listen to them to see what the differences are and the playing. So I'm going to riff a little on what they said and talk fairly briefly about this, and then we'll have the panel of journalists. I'll focus on three areas. The first is the major highlight that everybody agreed is the major highlight, and that is the public support for health insurance exchanges or markets. This year is the year of health insurance exchanges. I was going to look and see what year it, well, I did look and see what year it is in the Chinese calendar, and I decided that I wouldn't compare the Chinese calendar animal of the year to health insurance. But this is going to be the big year to implement health insurance exchanges. We're going to finalize the structure. We're going to start enrollment in October, and people will be getting health insurance under the program in January. It's reassuring. That first slide is reassuring that 55% of the people say that health exchanges should be the top priority for the state governors and legislatures. We have, at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, put a great deal of money into providing technical assistance to states to help them start up their exchanges. It's a major part of our effort on coverage in this year. It's a major part of our effort to get the uninsured, the nearly 50 million uninsured, insured. We will continue providing technical assistance to states during the next year. I think the second thing that I want to emphasize is the focus on prevention. Health insurance is critically important. Health insurance matters, as the Institute of Medicine said, but it's not sufficient. We spend $2.5 trillion annually on health care. We spend very little on prevention. But what is interesting is there is majority support in this poll, majority support for getting the federal government to prioritize prevention of chronic diseases as one of its priorities. Now, I happen to think that we should prioritize it. We should be working on keeping people from getting sick in the first place. It's the smart thing to do. And I think the findings on cost, I think that's the way we ought to be talking about this. It is a smart thing to do. It's a smart thing to work on prevention so that we don't go into the costly healthcare system. And I think you could, given these findings, that's the way I'd start pitching it instead of pitching it as a cost approach. And last, let me say something about the reversing the obesity epidemic. Reversing obesity is really core to the improvement of health in the United States. In 2007, we launched a $500 million commitment to reverse the epidemic amongst children. I'm struck by this poll, which shows that as, well, most of it, I'm not struck by the first finding, which is cancer, heart disease are in the top two in the poll. That's pretty consistent over time. But I am struck by the substantial increases in the public's feeling about obesity and diabetes as significant health issues. In 2007, when we started this, 6% were responding that it was a major health, that obesity was a major health threat. It's now jumped to 26%. Diabetes went from 14 to 30% in that time period. I think that is very important. Raising that awareness among the public is very important. Overall, these poll findings show that the public has priorities, and they include expanding coverage, they include prevention of disease. And in conclusion, I want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation and Harvard School of Public Health, and Bob and Molly in particular, for asking us to be a partner in this poll this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Terrific and amazingly succinct. My only disagreement is if I was going to use a Miles Davis song as a metaphor for health policy, I don't think it would be Bye Bye Blackbird. I think it would be Bitches Brew, but that's that's just me. I'm anxious to get to the other panel, but what I would like to do is open things up for just a few questions of us who are involved in doing the poll about the poll. Particularly urgent ones, because we should do that, and then we will move on to phase two of today's program. So, you know, please, just the kind of usual obvious rules. We have mics, and, you know, tell us who you are and where you're from and all that good stuff.
Hi, I'm Mike Miller. I'm a health policy consultant and physician. You guys talked about the gap between what people feel about Medicare versus what's happening here in Washington, feeling that's got to be focused for deficit reduction. Did you have any information from your polling about the gap between what Medicare used to be, traditional Medicare, and how it actually now is very different with, what, 25, 27% in Medicare Part C and another 4 million people in the new shared savings program, so that it largely is no longer the traditional Medicare that people think they want to be changing? Mm-hmm. Is there any, you know, did you ask people questions about how Medicare has changed and how they feel about it, or how that's going to affect deficit reduction? I realize it's a little amorphous question, but the debate always seems to be you've got to fix Medicare as if it's 1965 still.
Good question.
Thank you.
I'll just start. No, we didn't go into more details about how it's changed over time in this particular poll. I think one of the real important things to keep in mind is people's lack of familiarity with many of the details of any program. So, for example, the finding about how few people even recognize that higher-income seniors already pay a greater share for premiums, like, that's just not known. So some of these other changes, you know, we did a lot of survey work around the prescription drug debate and expanding Medicare to cover prescription drugs. And what we found is there was a lot of concern about changing the program, but they love the idea of a new benefit. And certainly when the benefit came into being, people really loved, and that actually worked out well for people. So I think the difference here is you're talking about some very specific, you know, policy changes over time that people may or may not be understanding. And what really they're telling us is that this is a really important program for me and my family. It matters. I don't have to worry about my parents because they're on Medicare. I know that they are getting the health care they need, and it's working well for them. And I think that's what people are reacting to and why they don't want to see any of these changes. I mean, the status quo, there is always a preference for the status quo, especially when the status quo is working well for people. So,
Mike, just one quick thing. This is very easy because we've all done a lot of work on Congressman Ryan's original plan. Choice is a wonderful thing, long as I can keep exactly what I have. And so the people who migrated over know they can go back and know that the Medicare that they had before is still there for them, and they got a better deal. Any proposal that says to people, you can have additional choices, and you might get a lot more, but you'll not lose what you have, will be very, very popular. But unbelievable high school graduates figured out there was something in the Ryan proposal, and it was the word fixed. You get a fixed amount of money. You pulled the word fixed out, people like choice. As soon as they got fixed, they got the idea that they weren't going to have the same amount. So there's a lot of change that can happen long as people feel that that which they had, which is working, they can keep. They'll migrate various places if it's better. But the I can keep what I have is very, very is the important issue. And if we sound like they won't like it. If it sounds like they can, they might be a lot more innovative than you would think.
Let's take a couple more.
Hi, my name is Mary Jennings. I'm a senior fellow with the National Center for Research on Women and Families. I had a question on slide 24. You asked people open-ended questions about what their priorities were, and 21% of people said they wanted healthcare access to be one of the priorities. Did you ask any further questions about what people meant by access, especially in the context of, you know, the individual mandate and the ACA kind of giving everyone health insurance?
What I would refer you to is that the way we do open-ended questions at that point is we ask them in their own words to describe what's important to them. And in the top lines, which are available on the website, you can get a lot more details about what they actually said when they said access. And so there are definitely some subcategories there. And if you come up afterwards, I'll show you where that is in there. And that should give you a little bit more flavor there.
Other questions? Got some in the back, too. Missed them. Not that I can see that far.
My turn?
Yeah.
Bruce Smith, retired Columbia professor, Brookings. Without quite challenging the raison d'etre of your effort here, I do want to recall that my first seminar in public opinion with the great scholar V.O. Key, who some might remember here, he said, if you fellows, and there were a few girls there too, take anything from this seminar, remember this. There is no such thing as public opinion. If by that you mean that there is something out there that our job is to be smart enough to measure. No, it's a process. It's an interaction between the politicians, the leaders, and the led and the public. In that regard, are we worrying too much about what the fine points of the public know this, that, and next? We know that they don't know what Part B now is and that you pay more and they take $209 out of my Social Security for Part B. If the politicians agree, as they did in the Lincoln movie, can't they carry the day on public opinion?
Well, that is...
Yes or no?
Yes. And that is absolutely, absolutely correct.
If there is no partisan disagreement, so the original Social Security compromise, which Bob Dole sat, overcame public opinion by having three of each party hold hands and raise retirement age. If three sat there and wait for the next election, I don't think the O'Keefes will be correct here. I think the other party will rub it raw enough that you'll be very sorry that you took that walk. So the politicians have to cut off the partisanship advantages. Just so we get from 40 years ago to now is both parties want a grand bargain. I can't find a detail in either side. They want the other side to say what Medicare would look like before they come to the table. That is the nervousness about this public opinion about this issue.
But it is ever-changing. It is part of the process. It does change. Leaders can change it. How does obesity change? Yes, he's right.
As a fan of V.O. Key, probably one of the people in the room who knows V.O. Key, and I think if you sort of look at the studies that Robert Shapiro and his students did over the years, what you see is there are sometimes when public opinion is driving the policy process, and there are sometimes when the leaders are driving the public opinion. And so I think this is a time when we need to figure out how leaders can drive the public opinion.
You have to especially, I think, worry about the public and the gap between the policymakers, the experts, and the public in a budget debate. Very fast-moving decisions made in the dead of night. They have to put lots of technical things together quickly, but the public doesn't understand. And that's where you can have big problems. So especially when policy is made in the context of a budget debate, I think these kinds of gaps really matter. Let's take one more, and then we'll move on to the panel.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Adams with CQ Health Aid. Hey, thanks Rebecca. Very much for doing this. I wanted to kind of follow up and ask about the familiarity of the public, following up on what Molly said and what you all have said. Did you test how well versed they were on some of these concepts and if they know what an exchange is? For example, with the malleability in Medicaid, it made me think they perhaps had not heard those arguments before. So did you test what they thought after hearing both arguments too? And I also wanted to ask if the public is not familiar with this, are we facing a real problem given that open enrollment starts October 1st?
Well, I'll start with the knowledge side. In this particular survey, we did not tackle levels of knowledge in any depth, but we have done that quite a bit over time, and you can see that. And I'm happy to point you to some of those findings over the last couple months. I would say that that certainly many of these terms and ideas are not well understood among the public, but in general, they're reacting to the idea here is to measure what they're reacting to when they hear these terms and debates in the media, when leaders talk to them and those kinds of things. And we can show you where knowledge matters and where knowledge doesn't matter on some of these things. I think that we have seen over time that if we wait till the public is perfectly informed, then we'll be waiting forever before we can actually do policy. So again, this dynamic between both leaders and leading, even in the face of a public who might not understand every detail, but also respecting that the public has very strongly held values and beliefs and a really good sense of what is right and wrong for them and their family, and actually, making some sense of that. And in terms of enrollment, the enrollment issue coming up, I think that is a big topic. I think a lot of people are concerned and paying a lot of attention to that right now. There's a lot of need to do a lot of outreach and a lot of education with that outreach, and it's going to have to be incredibly targeted. I mean, I would personally argue against, big national campaigns and instead really focus on targeted information, approaches to the people who will be most relevant for the enrollment process. And I know there's a lot of people working hard on that. In fact, I think both of you are working on it a little bit. I don't know if you want to say more.
Well, We've had a lot of experience in enrollment. We sponsored for a number of years Covering Kids and Families program, which was a program in 50 states trying to enroll children in SCHIP and Medicaid. We are now actually doing some studies, looking back and trying to see if we can get the best practices that we can use in the future. So we've got two studies going on right now to look at that experience.
You know, we've known since we started polling on the ACA, that the overall idea of the ACA plays to very mixed public reaction, and certainly if you call it Obamacare. But most of the benefits of the ACA are very popular, even many on a bipartisan basis. And my guess is that the surface reaction to the concept of exchanges feels more to the public, like something that might be helpful to them than another ideological ACA issue. And now, having gotten this finding in a very broad poll about lots of things, I think exchanges is something we want to follow up on and pursue in much greater depth in our future tracking polls, and so we will do that. Okay, thank you, and let's get the second panel up here, and we will move on to the second stage. And change the names, right. Hello, sister. I think you're here. All right. Okay, so those of you who regularly attend our events probably remember that I don't really do conventional introductions. These are just amazing journalists, and you know, you all know that they went to different schools and they were all born somewhere, and they've worked most of their careers. But most importantly, they are among a handful of folks that we just all rely on, so much to know what is happening, but to understand what is happening. I know I do, and I'm just really thrilled to have them here. Jackie Combs from the New York Times focuses on fiscal and economic issues and politics with just truly just fabulous reporting. And also many of us remember her great reporting at the Wall Street Journal for many years. And David is the economics editor and columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and I'm sure many of you hear him on NPR, and you all have a copy of his new bestseller, which is called If You Don't, You Will Have, at the end of this event, Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. I especially admire David for his award-winning work, I guess at the Globe, on racism in Boston. The reason for that is that I started my career as an academic at MIT doing studies of busing and racism in Boston. So I actually paid close attention to that work. And, of course, health journalism's Julie Robner is a fixture in our world and the go-to source of reporting on our issues and a source of endless frustration to us health policy experts, because she actually knows as much as we know, and we hate that. And a close working partner for Kaiser Health News and a good friend. So I thought, they have all come with some initial thoughts that the best thing to do would be to start in the most, I have some questions, but the most uncreative way imaginable. And you know, there's also a rule in these things that I learned 25 years ago in media training, which is ignore the question and say what you plan to say anyway, which is I encourage. So let me just start by getting your reactions to the poll and anything surprise you, nothing, what is your take? But this is really the invitation to make whatever opening statement you would like to make about the subject for today. We can, let's go this way, and we'll start with David.
Sure, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. So my first reaction to the poll is we're sure as hell not going to be able to fix our deficit by a public opinion poll. There's a combination here of contradictory impulses. I mean, it's really remarkable. 65% of the people say the Congress and the president should deal with the deficit now and not wait for the economy to get better. That's even more than said at the last time they took this poll. But they basically rule out cutting absolutely anything that represents a huge part of the federal budget. 58% oppose spending cuts to Medicare and Social Security, 46% cuts to Medicaid. So what do they want to cut? Foreign aid, again. Salaries and benefits for government workers. Well, you know, if you fired every single government worker, cut their salaries, cut their benefits, all of them, from the president to the lady taking tolls at Yellowstone, you'd only cut the deficit by about 40%. We're not going to get there that way. The war in Afghanistan, well, we've pretty much cut that already. Unemployment insurance and food stamps, which surprised me, and defense. Okay, so defense, there's a lot of money there, 20% of the federal budget. But basically, we're not going to get here by waiting for the people to come to consensus on what to do with the deficit. I think that there's not a gap between the experts and the public. There's a gap between the public and reality. And unfortunately, the campaign did very little to fix that. I mean, I thought among the many low points of the campaign, and there's probably more than we have time to go over, the moment where Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, each of whom has a budget that proposes cutting Medicare, that is cutting in the Washington sense, slowing the rate of growth, accuses the other one of cutting Medicare and calls that a debate about health policy, I think shows that there's nothing that the politicians are doing that's going to make this any clearer to the public. So I think in contrast, and I was kind of intrigued by this, I don't know what to make of the finding, perhaps the debate about taxes was a little more informative. There's a large – the debate about taxes was more on the substance. There were disagreements about who to tax and how to run the tax system. And it was intriguing to me that so many people in the poll were willing to entertain limiting deductions, which I took as perhaps a symptom that that debate had gotten through. The problem is, and I'll close on this, both for the public and for the Congress, is there really isn't any urgency to do anything about the deficit. I mean, you can have Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson scare you out of your socks. But in fact, the deficit's coming down. Interest rates are at very low levels. There is no reason to do this. And we're not going to fix this without either a crisis. They tried the legislative crisis with the fiscal cliff, and you saw how far we got with that. Or a real crisis, like a financial market crisis, which could come any day now, but the Europeans do such a good job of looking worse than we do that day seems a thing. Or an outbreak of leadership. And I don't see much chance of that either.
We should come back to the implications of the gap between the public and reality, which is a great way to put it. Jackie.
I thought David was going to, by the way, I almost thought I couldn't commit to this because it was just a couple days after the, thank you, you're more adept and more experienced at this.
Younger.
Because it was... No, you're 6 months older. He forgets I worked with him, which is my point, that when I was afraid to commit to something like this just a couple days, in the same week as the inaugural, since I cover the White House, but then when I found out that who the other two panelists were, I've worked with each of them, you know, David for 18 years at the Wall Street Journal, and Julie before that at Congressional Quarterly. So I thought I was in really good company. I thought David was going to steal my low point of the campaign. My favorite low point, and actually had the benefit of being a pox on both your houses. Mine is the whole campaign against the from the Republicans that the Democrats were raiding Medicare of $716 billion. And it's what it's remarkable to me, and I'm complicit in this too as a member of the press, is that they just turned on a dime. We went straight from the election results to the fiscal cliff debate, and all you heard was about Republicans saying that Democrats don't want to cut entitlement, they don't want to cut Medicare. And I'm like, the public must be so confused. And so this goes to the whole point about why polls suggest such a level of confusion. When I first saw the poll results, I mean, they're not any surprise to me. For years, I worked on the Wall Street Journal NBC polls. I now dabble in the New York Times CBS polls. So this idea that people don't want to cut the very things that are the biggest drivers of the national debt is not a huge surprise, but it nevertheless never ceases to be humbling and a bit depressing, since I've spent much of my career since the mid-'80s writing about this very thing. In fact, in the 80s at CQ, I can remember quoting Robert Reichauer, who a lot of you know of, predicting the coming tsunami, demographic tsunami of aging baby boomers who would draw so heavily on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security that we needed to get our finances in order now to be able to withstand that. So it's a bit depressing. You realize that, you know, you're writing for the elites, apparently. But at the same time, when you're also writing, the same public is getting information from their politicians like that we saw in the last campaign. You know, why should it be any wonder that people think you can, do this without cutting Medicare? And, you know, the other popular misconception is people think, and again, campaigns play into this, that they've paid for what they get, when we all know they have not. I've always thought it would take a level of leadership that people are not providing at the political level. And just yesterday, Paul Ryan was the guest at the Wall Street Journal's first breakfast for newsmakers. And I wanted to ask him about this idea. How do you feel? You know, he was coming back. He started out in his remarks, and the very first responses to David and Jerry Seib about, again, that Democrats don't want to take on entitlements. But there were just so many other questions that presented themselves and so many people in the room, you know, how he felt going, I mean, how sort of depressing it is that the one man who got so many points as a truth teller in the Republican Party went on to be a running mate on a ticket that he, on the very first week he was on that ticket, was pressing this $716 billion attack line against the Democrats when he, to his credit, had withheld doing that as just a member of Congress and a House member, and in fact had raised objections privately with his colleagues. The Medicaid, I was interested in the Medicaid, the comment that it, and the evidence in the poll that it's slightly up in support. For much of my career in writing about this, it was thought of as the program for poor people, you know, women and children and unmarried mothers and the like. But now I think that popularity must reflect the fact that more and more aging baby boomers are putting their parents in nursing homes and long-term care and are realizing that Medicaid is much more than just a program and increasingly is becoming a program for the aged, contrary to the, you know, probably opinion that's still held by a lot of people. I was interested, one last thing in the poll, there was page 6, the statement that the public may react more favorably to changes in the program if they are placed in the context of attempts to save and preserve the program itself rather than present it in a way to reduce the deficit. That was interesting and intriguing to me. I mean, we've already seen that with Social Security, both with President Bush's attempt in 2005 to take on and change Social Security, which he did, since his entire presidency, he did not spend any time trying to reduce deficits. It was all in the context of preserving Social Security. And then we saw it again in 2010 with the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which had proposals for Social Security but made a very strong point of sort of like segregating that we want to do this, but it's not part of our calculations for bringing down the debt. We're doing this for the sake of Social Security itself. I'm not so sure it will work. It's intriguing. If you approached Medicare from that standpoint, could you maybe get more support? And I really sort of doubt it, because there's a part of me that thinks that if you approach people thinking the federal debt is this dangerous in the future, and the biggest driver of it is, as far as spending goes, is Medicare spending and healthcare spending, then maybe that should appeal to people's sense of, you know, economic patriotism, perhaps, and it hasn't really. you know, in a sort of sense of generational obligation to preserve both the program and bring down the debt for the sake of their children and grandchildren. It also didn't work in the Clinton second term when he tried to take on entitlements for their own sake, not so much as a part of deficit reduction. With that, I'll just turn to the expert on the panel, Julie, and look
sister.
For your questions.
My sister. Thank you.
Well, I have to say, first of all, it's very nice to sit on a panel. It's the first time since I can remember in a long time. I'm actually the youngest person here, although not by much.
You can leave now.
I'm never the youngest person here. Thank you. I got a lot of sense of deja vu reading this, and I wondered why. And so I went and pulled out this, which looks remarkably similar to what you all have, except this is the public health care agenda. Yeah, Molly Ann is laughing. For the 112th Congress. So this is from 2 years ago. And now, granted, a lot of the questions were worded differently because the situation has changed. But there was also a lot of things that were very common. 2 years ago, for instance, views on government health care were partisan. That is the same now. 2 years ago, a majority of the public wanted to reduce the deficit, but not by cutting Medicare. Same theme. One thing that did jump out at me a little bit is that the opinion seems to have diverged a little bit on Medicaid. Now, I know that in general, opinion on Medicaid is up. But in fact, in 2011, 67% of people favored expanding Medicaid, 32% opposed. Now it's actually 52-42, although, as I mentioned, the questions are different because the circumstances changed with the Supreme Court. I'm wondering, though, how much of that is now with all of these Republican governors coming out and saying, hell no, we're not going to expand Medicaid over our dead bodies. But that led me to wonder how much people actually know about these sorts of things. And, of course, you can see that opinion is, as pollsters like to say, malleable, as in when you give people more information, they're prone to change their minds. You can see that in this poll, as in many others. Frankly, as someone who's been covering health for 27 years now, I know the average person on the street or even the average member of Congress can't always tell you the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. Sometimes my colleagues on the science desk at NPR can't tell you the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. And while it is my job to explain that, every time I feel like a failure, I just remember the story of Donna the Deer Lady. Now, if you are not one of the couple of million people or so who has seen Donna's now infamous YouTube video, which is really just an audio with picture, I will explain. Donna called a Fargo radio station last fall to complain that she'd had three recent separate deer accidents and wondered why the State Department of Transportation allowed deer to cross at high traffic areas and even put up signs urging the deer to do so. I mean, I've even seen them on the interstates. Why are we encouraging deer to cross at the interstate? I do not get it, she said. Even after the oh-so-polite radio host tried to explain that, well, deer can't read and the signs are to warn people, Donna continued to urge that the signs be moved to lower traffic areas, and that would surely move the deer as well. Now, there was a follow-up interview with Donna, which you can also see on YouTube, whose last name we never did get, in which it appeared someone had finally set her straight and she confessed to feeling, well, dumb. There is also, I will add, some question as to whether Donna is a real person or maybe another of Monty Teo's ex-girlfriends. But what she represents, Donna, not fake people on Twitter, is something very real. If you think deer crossing signs are hard to help people understand, try health policy. And in the presence of a knowledge vacuum, as we all know, it is very easy to mislead or frighten people. I have been doing this long enough to have covered the Medicare Catastrophic Coverage Act, which did pass, I might add, going back to the earlier conversation, with bipartisan coverage. And in the knowledge vacuum that was then created, it was then repealed because a lot of people got scared who didn't understand what was in it. So I think that's a lot of what we're seeing right now. There is, in fact, a knowledge vacuum about not just the Affordable Care Act, but about Medicare and Medicaid and still what they do. Democrats tend to believe what their thought leaders tell them, and I also attribute that to Democrats in Congress who are believing what their leadership is telling them. Republicans the same. They believe what their thought leaders tell them. And to paraphrase what Drew here has been saying at these briefings, oh, what about every 6 months for the past 3 years? People won't really understand this law until they experience it. Hence, Medicare, as we know, is popular, as is keeping your grown children on your health plan until they are 26. So 2013 is going to be a big transition year as we prepare for the pieces of the ACA that take effect in 2014. But if I had to guess, I would say we're going to spend most of 2013 with a lot more of the same old, same old.
Okay. So, Jackie, the speculation about getting slightly different results if the cuts are to preserve programs for the future is actually based on real poll findings, which we'll share with you. It's not a dramatic effect, but it's a modest effect. I want to ask you guys two questions, and not more than that, because I know people want to ask you questions. The first one is, let's forget public opinion for a minute because it's too depressing. I just do want to ask you what you think is going to happen with the big entitlement programs, Medicare and Medicaid, and also maybe also the ACA in the budget debate as it unfolds, if you have a crystal ball about what might happen or just how you see it playing out. And let's go the other way this time. We can start with you.
I keep wondering if we're going to actually have a budget debate.
Okay.
I'm serious. I mean, you know, or if we're every time, every 3 months, we're going to, you know, do the old kick the can down the road again. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing we've been doing, this SGR thing with Medicare physician pay for 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, more than 6 years, but let's delay it a little bit for 6 years now. And every time, at least the original theory behind the delay was, let's give ourselves a year so that we can solve the problem. I have yet to see, there was a little tiny flurry of activity in the House last year about thinking about solving the problem, but mostly they pass something to delay it, and then they just wait until they get close to the next time it comes up, and it's like, oh my God, we have to delay it again. I never actually see any work, which is what worries me about, you know, the budget things. They keep putting it off, and then you see absolutely no work on having a budget deal. All you see is a whole lot of rhetoric, and then the next time the deadline comes around. So I'd like to know from these two if they actually think we're going to have a budget discussion.
Okay.
I think we're going to have a lot of debate. The question is whether we get results. We've had now in 2011, if you count interest, upwards of $1.7 trillion over 10 years in discretionary spending, which includes some health spending, but
discretionary cuts.
Then in this fiscal cliff deal, we have a roughly $620 to $650 billion in additional revenues coming in over the next 10 years compared to a baseline that anticipated that all the Bush-era tax rates would be extended. So that's, you know, $2.5 trillion nearly over 10 years. What's missing, again, are the very thing we're talking about, are entitlements. I really don't see this president, and there's been a lot of commentary about just how forceful his inaugural address was this week. Even before that address, and I, for all of his image as being somebody who caves or too quick to compromise, I really don't see this president giving ground on entitlement spending unless there are also revenues in the package. I do think, however, I know that this president would like to see some significant reductions in entitlement in spending, Medicare in particular. Obviously, he's expanded Medicaid if he had his way, but as a matter of legacy, because he knows, as Bill Clinton also knows, I remember writing these stories back at the Journal when I covered his second term, that when people look back on entitlement spending as it squeezes, you know, it's like the deficit is coming down in the short term, but then it's projected to go up again as more of the baby boomers have aged and are living longer. Presidents think really hard about legacy, and both Clinton and Obama know that historians will look back, you know, in the 2030s and see which presidents did not address this. George Bush is already in trouble for having added to Medicare by virtue of the prescription drug benefit and then not paying for it at all. I mean, Democrats, as we know, always wanted that Medicare prescription drug benefit too, but they just couldn't figure out how to pay for it. And the answer George Bush came up with was you don't. And so anyway, he already will bear culpability for that, but it's a very popular and, you know, inarguably necessary benefit. to make Medicare complete. I think to come back to the original question and just say what might happen this year, the most I see happening is looking at what President Obama has proposed up till now. You don't get a lot of the details in our news stories. I'm sure Kaiser News provides them regularly. But, you know, he does, contrary to the conventional wisdom that he doesn't have any details. He does. It's there in his budget. It was there in his September 2011 deficit reduction plan he put out after his budget. They're just not very sexy, and people in this room pretty much know what they are. But other than the drug rebates, higher drug rebates for Medicare, people, they're pretty hard to convey in, say, a New York Times story. And I think, you know, if the Republicans will give on revenues, he will give on the cost of living adjustment in Social Security, because he's pretty much lost his virginity several times over on that one. And on the other hand, I think he never did like the idea of raising the Medicare retirement age in 2011, and he likes it even less now, and as best I can tell, it's all but persuaded he will not agree to that, because in the meantime, you've had the Supreme Court decision, as you all know, that said the states had the option of not expanding Medicaid, which creates additional problems for those people that get thrown into that who are between 65 and 67. So my best case scenario, to sum it all up, is that there would be an agreement to overhaul the tax code and project that you'll get X number of revenues over 10 years from that, along with changing the entitlement programs like with CPI and some of these Medicare provisions that the president has already got in his budget. That said, those are agreements that anticipate further action, which the tax part in particular would be really hard to get.
Before we move to David, though, so do you see a continuing line in the sand from the administration anyway on Medicaid and also going after savings from the ACA?
One of the things I wanted to learn here today is what sort of savings, if any, we can see that are being realized as a result of the 2010 Health Care Act, and are there any findings yet really on where savings might come from the various demonstration projects? But I think the president and his administration officials are pretty set against cutting Medicaid. I mean, it's really... Jack Lew sort of was personified that in the administration.
There were a few things in the budget that proposal last year, but it was mostly drug rebates.
You know, $200 billion over 10 years.
Compared to the budget itself, it was pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you need to divide the budget and the ACA. I think the Republicans know the ACA is here to stay. The voters decided that in November. They may try and nickel and dime it and make it hard to administer, and I'm sure that would be a frustration to the administration. But I really think a whole lot rides on how it's implemented. And the conversation earlier about how the enrollment works, I'm kind of intrigued by this Enroll America organization, which is a bunch of insurance companies and spinoffs of the Obama campaign. There's clearly going to be a big effort of public education. And I think that's really important. Would be the worst of all possible worlds if we created a benefit to reduce the number of uninsured, and then we went through all this trouble and we didn't reduce the number of uninsured. I think that we all pick different historical metaphors, and Julie's right to raise the catastrophic. It's the one that tells us that if Congress does something that people don't like, Congress might change its mind. On the other hand, I'm pretty impressed with Part D of Medicare. In the beginning, Part D of Medicare, we wrote endless stories. It was so complicated. The old people would never be able to figure it out. The price was – estimates were way underestimated and so forth. And if you look back, A, nobody talks about Part D. It's kind of just part of the system. B, turns out that in a world of Amazon and Google, that even elderly people can figure out how to pick an insurance plan off the internet. And if they can't, their sons or daughters will help them, and they always end up with the AARP plan, that it didn't cost more than estimated. It cost less. I heard a wonderful discussion at an American Economics Association meeting once where Dan McFadden had, and a noted economist, had done this great analysis of the choices people made and said, lo and behold, very few people made stupid choices. And then there was a woman in the audience who was an old battle axe, had been at HICFA for a long time, and she said, well, it's not surprising because we didn't give them any bad choices to make, that the structure of the market in Part D is actually, you know, you can make some choices, but there's no really lousy products. So I think a lot is going to depend on how these exchanges function. There are going to be horror stories, and there are going to be glitches, and it doesn't help any that half the states are trying to subvert them. But
remember, the first 6 months of Part D were no fun.
Right. But the question is, over time, do people begin to think that, you know, this isn't so bad, and it might actually work? And there are a lot of people in the system, health insurers and the Obama administration, to name two, who have an interest in making this work. So I think it's on them. We pretty much know they don't know how to market the ACA. There's outside of this room, there's nobody who understands, couldn't tell you three things that are in the ACA if you asked them. We'll learn whether they can administer and execute it. On the deficit, I don't think anything's going to happen. I think we'll have a lot of debate and nothing will happen. You know, they may make some modest cuts in some programs, but to do anything significant on the deficit is going to require a sense between Republicans and Democrats that it's in their interest to compromise. It'll have to have some taxes, and it'll have to have some more restraint on health care and perhaps Social Security spending than the Democrats like. And I don't see any sign at the moment that in our polarized political system, as each party makes its own calculations to go forward, that's going to happen. I agree with Jackie that Barack Obama would like it to happen, because Barack Obama knows that without doing something about the deficit, the federal government will become a giant health and retirement insurance operation with a few tanks and a big interest tab. And there won't be room for anything else that makes a difference to the next generation. And I've heard him say that. But, you know, intentions are not what gets this stuff done. If you listen to Paul Ryan's intentions and Barack Obama's intentions, you think, well, a piece of cake. In a few weeks, these guys could come to a compromise. But that's not really where we are. And as I say, without some external pressure, either from the public or the markets, to do something, I'm afraid we'll have a number of skirmishes and no real progress, and it'll be bequeathed to the next Congress and maybe the next president.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
In the middle of December, I remember hearing so many reporters talking, mostly White House reporters, talking about how close the two sides were because they were just talking about the math. They were saying, oh, they're only, you know, $1.6 billion apart. We're this close to getting, you know, a deal. And I kept saying, having covered innumerable of these budget, you know, deals before, I said, you don't understand. They're nowhere near on the policy. It doesn't matter that they're close on the number. They are miles and miles and continents apart on the policy. And if it's the policy that they can't get together on, and that's what I agree
right.
with David.
And I'm
just not seeing them anywhere in the same, not just in the same room. They're just, you know, they're on the opposite coasts on the policy still.
Right. And, you know, you don't have to be a public opinion specialist to realize that there is something to this polarization argument. The Congress is polarized. The public is polarized. People tend to live with people who have closer to their incomes and share their political views than before. The country is pretty split on a lot of these issues, so it's a bad environment. Bob, I just want to make one response to something you alluded to after we answered the first round of questions, is about, you know, public attitudes and ignorance and what our role is. So, A, yes, the public is ignorant, right? 20% of the people in this survey knew that Medicare upper-income beneficiaries pay more, right? The public has always been ignorant. You know, in 1776 and 1863, there weren't a whole lot of, you know, people there sitting by candlelight reading the details. So that's life. All of us are in the business of trying to reduce the amount of ignorance, and we should never stop trying. And the Internet makes it a ton easier. I mean, I've done animations on the deficit and these games like the one the Wilson Center has where you get people to make choices and they see that you can wipe out foreign aid and it doesn't move the needle at all are constructive, right? They're never going to get us there, but they're instructive. But I do think that where the public opinion, and I like Bob's idea that this is a weather forecast, matters is that somewhere innately people do want to know that if we ever do a deal, it'll be fair. Mm-hmm. And that is not easily measured by, you know, distribution tables. That is really measured in attitudes. And so understanding that, for instance, upper-income people do pay more for Medicare is important if we do something that's going to affect everybody. Or understanding that how the tax burden is distributed, having some sense of that, it's important to the fairness thing. And there's where I think a little more information and people being able to discuss openly, you know, look, if we're going to cut the deficit, somebody's going to pay more taxes and somebody's going to get less from the government. There's no magic elixir here. We're not going to grow fast enough to do this. And people want to have the sense that everybody else is giving a little bit too, and there what we see in the polls is that they're very suspicious. And so if we ever got one of these, can you imagine? We got a grand bargain. John Boehner, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and Mitch McConnell and Barack Obama face the cameras, and they say, we did what you wanted. We dealt with entitlements. We dealt with taxes. We've reduced the deficit. Nobody's happy. It's nobody's first choice. We did the best we could. We tried to share the pain evenly. Trust us. And there's none of that. I mean, the reason we in the press love this Gallup poll where they rank institutions by how much confidence people have in them is no matter how low we fall, Congress is always a couple notches below us. And that's really going to be hard if the politicians are going to say to people, you're not going to get everything you were promised, and you're going to have to pay more taxes. So it's a very dangerous environment, and we're coasting. We're coasting because the rest of the world is willing to send us a lot of money to finance this profligacy. And someday that's going to end. I don't know when. And then we'll regret that we didn't deal with it soon enough.
Really well put, and it sets up the – I want to ask you one last question, then open it up. It's we're an organization that cares deeply about journalism. We operate our own news service, and that's the basis for this question. Briefly, I want to ask you what you see from each of your vantage points as the coverage challenges, the journalism challenges for you over the next year, what you're struggling with as you approach covering all these tricky issues over the next year.
Well, I'll be really brief and start. One, it's really hard in a polarized environment. I mean, we labor against the curse of, quote, balance, right? Some things are true and some things are not true. We have to make choices, and there's a disagreement of the choices, but I struggle at the Journal to help my colleagues know when we can say that is not true, even though a politician said it. And quoting another politician saying it's not true is not our job. That's the first thing. And that's probably the overriding thing. The second thing is, all this stuff is really complicated, and we're all struggling to find ways to make it more black and white than it really is. I used this once in a column. I can't remember what the Kaiser summary of the ACA is, how many pages it is in telephone book size type, something like 37 pages. Well, I write a column that's 800 words. I do 3 minutes and 45 seconds on NPR. It's kind of hard to get into the subtleties, and we're always trying to simplify it, but not oversimplify it. But that's easy compared to the first challenge of avoiding the curse of false balance.
I will just pick up on David, because what I was going to say is more, I've been doing this, covering public policy either in Texas for a few years and then for the last 28 in Washington, and I've never had such experience, a hard time as I've had in recent years of this idea of being seen, that there's always going to be half the public that's ready to jump on something you've written, assuming that you're biased against what they believe. And I'm not doing anything different. For the 18 years I was at the Wall Street Journal, well, towards the end when there was such a thing as email and internet, it seemed like people thought the worst they could say to me or write to me was, why don't you go to the New York Times where you belong? So I did. But then now I'm at the New York Times and I get people saying, you're one of those elite Harvard types, I'm sure, who doesn't know what it's like to live on Social Security. Well, no, in fact, I'm from Toledo, Ohio, and my mother raised 5 kids on Social Security survivor benefits. But that's what you get constantly from people because they're busy watching either Fox or MSNBC, And then they have ideas that are the politicians are playing to their preconceived ideas and prejudices about these programs, and as opposed to relying on facts. And yet I'm constantly, you know, just as the Wall Street Journal was sensitive to not being, you know, seen as too conservative in its news columns, the New York Times is very sensitive to being seen as too sympathetic or supportive of Democrats, like I said, I'm not doing anything different, but when people are ready to think that any New York Times reporter has a certain bias in their news coverage, it makes it hard. And I think that there is a false equivalence going on where we in the dread mainstream media are seen as, you know, if you say something that's critical about Democrats, then you have to quickly add, but Republicans are just as bad, some such formulation. And frankly, I think two of the most courageous people in Washington right now are Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann for the work they've done in saying, you know what, they're both bad. We can stipulate that. And part of the reason they're bad is because the public demands that they say stupid things that aren't really true. But frankly, the Republican Party right now is worse when it comes to some of these issues. And it's because of the system of they've become a congressional wing party that is based in districts that are gerrymandered to within an inch, and so are Democratic districts. But, you know, so that you have a situation where John Boehner cannot lead his caucus to do what he thinks his caucus really should do. John Boehner knows that if he had cut this deal, how in the world did we end up at the end of December, beginning of January, with a deal that did nothing but raise taxes when one of the parties that controls one of the three levers of power is supposed to be the anti-tax party? But they were so dug in that they so blew the negotiations. They could have had Social Security CPI for that, you know, for just a few more revenues than they were forced to help pass. Could have had that and could have had other changes that they've been wanting and still want. And instead they got tax increases and nothing for it. And it's because they're just because they can't be led, because you've heard the quotes. They think they have just as big a mandate as Barack Obama does because they kept their majority in the House, and they are from districts where, to be fair to them, they'll be out in the next Republican primary if they cut a deal with Barack, or are seen as supporting a deal with Barack Obama. And I think in one of the things I'm watching, and then I'll stop, for the 2014 midterms, is there's a lot of talk in Georgia that Saxby Chambliss, who's a guy who has really been quite courageous in his party, and, you know, you don't have to agree with him, but he's been out there with Mark Warner, and he's been willing. He was willing early on, wasn't on the Simpson-Bowles Commission, but immediately signed, you know, was supportive of the idea that Republicans have to be for raising revenues as part of a balanced package with entitlement reductions. And he ought to be a shoe-in for re-election in a state like Georgia, but he's not, because there's a lot of talk, the Republicans who are gearing up to run against him in the primary, because he's been for raising taxes. And so you already are seeing indications where he's much more quiet. You haven't seen him quoted much on this front, and it was quiet through the entire fiscal cliff debate post-election, because he's in cycle, and so is Mitch McConnell. So I think that's my biggest makes me most pessimistic as a citizen and as a journalist, is that you have this situation. I think the Republican Party is going to have to shake itself out, just like Democrats did when I was very young and still in college, and they were so far to the left that they lost a lot of public support and couldn't get things done. So in the meantime, I'll agree with David again that it takes a crisis to get further action that's really meaningful on this front.
I think there are just 37 or so swing districts left. It's really changed. Julie.
Yeah, I'm going to echo basically what both Jackie and David said. I mean, I think the hardest thing that's really happened in the last couple of years is the propensity of elected officials to just say things that are demonstrably not true. And it's very hard to come out and say, you know, we have at least a forum where we can take, you know, we called it various things, fact check, or we called it Is That So for a while. But, I mean, unless you're doing a story where you're calling out that particular comment, it's very difficult, particularly in health policy where it's already complicated, to say to come back and say that's just not the case. And it's difficult, as I say, both as a citizen and as a journalist and as something of a specialist. I mean, it's hard to call someone saying that's not the case, and there's more and more of it, and they're doing it. And, you know, as on the one hand, the Internet makes things better as a journalist. On the other hand, the Internet makes things worse as a journalist because there's so much out there that you look at and just shake your head and know that it's not true, but people are believing it, and it makes it very difficult. And then people write to you and say, oh, but I can point to this that says, you know, that blah, 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 and that's exactly the opposite of what's in your story. I said, yes, it is, and it's also not true. So
I think there's also a danger that the agenda becomes manipulated, even if you're fact-checking and doing your job. So the agenda becomes death panels. You're fact-checking, but it's about death panels. And so journalism becomes part of the process instead of separate from it, holding it accountable. And I worry a lot about that, too. Let's get a few questions for these amazing people. If there are questions, I hope. Yep, here we go.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the presentation. Before I ask my question, my name is Milena Sullivan, and I'm a healthcare policy consultant. But before I ask my question, I would like to say that this was an incredibly useful opinion poll, and it's very interesting in terms of the debate that's happening here in Washington. But my question actually is, when we say that the politicians need to lead the way and guide public opinion, meanwhile we have this obsession with polls. We saw that especially during the campaign. Trying to capture this margin or that margin or the African-American vote and this other minority vote than the female vote. Are the opinion polls useful at this point, or are they kind of a distraction?
Well, I certainly have an answer, but I want to let our guests take it.
I love polls. Like a lot of other things, they can be misused. But that, you know, at best, you look at a poll and you see what people think, like we see in this particular poll, and you see the best politicians truly try to lead and educate their constituents. So it tells you what they think, and you go out and, you know, hold town meetings. I mean, this is the ideal and the unrealistic ideal, but. And try to lead. I was trying to think of an example where I've seen that actually happen in all these years. But and I do have some. I just can't think of them. And I just want to quickly take that opportunity. I've been tough on Republicans. I should also say I think I see a lot more, and I'm feeling a lot more from the left where it's digging in on the entitlement front and more than it has in recent years. And so in part in response to the thrashing they've been getting from the right. But so to that extent, my other hero in Washington is Bob Greenstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who is one lefty, proud lefty, who knows that unless entitlement spending is controlled, it's going to squeeze out all these other programs for low-income people that he cares so much about on the discretionary spending side. I just wanted to try to, you know, get a little equivalence there. Like, we're always trying to be, like, you know, in the middle.
Fair enough.
It's kind of like asking, is TV good or bad? I mean, we have polls. So I think that we learned in the campaign that you can win an election through social science. I mean, Barack Obama showed that how effective polling and targeting and micro-targeting and knowing and using technology can be. So I think that... that will continue. The question is, will politicians learn from public opinion polls and focus groups and all that how to help persuade people of what needs to be done? Or will it all become a contest to position yourself so you can get elected next time? And I think that's really what you're asking, and I see that tension and don't know how it'll be resolved.
What I actually worry about, and I don't think this is what you were looking for, is that in the new world where most elected officials come from a very red district, usually safe, or very blue district, the views of the public and interests of the public overall get lost because the pressure is to worry about just the sliver of the electorate you represent. I think in that context, knowing what the public thinks, and also groups of the public
who aren't well represented in the process actually becomes more important. That's just my view. Other questions?
I have a question. So one of the things that we've talked about today is the misinformation out there about the ACA, and that one part says this and one part says that. And I know with the internet, when there's wild misinformation, there's Snopes.com. And so instead of you as a journalist having to tell people in your 800-word column, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, it kind of puts the power into the people, and that people can say to their, you know, Aunt Marlise, oh, there wasn't a monkey in a Kia, as it turned out, it was a dog that got away. So I wondered if, do you see a possibility, or perhaps it's already out there, of something that could have the correct factual information on the ACA that, again, puts the power into people to be able to say, you know, Aunt Dorothy, that's actually not true, you know, whatever it is, that the government doesn't get $1 million Cadillac health care?
Well, we already have, you know, factcheck.org and PolitiFact. And, you know, and they do a pretty good job. The problem is this stuff is really, really complicated. And so, I mean, yes, you get the really wild stuff, you know, about the, I thought there was a monkey at IKEA. See? But I actually went to Snopes about Donna the Deer Lady, who says we still don't know, really know whether she was real or not. So there's limits to this stuff. But it is, I mean, even I have disagreed with some of the stuff I've seen on both PolitiFact and Fact Check. I mean, and then you have the problems of people, and I will say more on the right than on the left, attacking PolitiFact and attacking Fact Check. And so even then, you know, and they are, and PolitiFact is a journalistic enterprise. So some of this is a matter of interpretation. So it is very, very difficult. And some of this stuff, as we saw with the Supreme Court, is only going to be decided by a judge. So to some extent you can, but to some extent, some of it is a little, you know, yes. I mean, some of the stuff that went on during the campaign was completely and utterly not true, and there's a lot of stuff that can be proved not true. Some of it, as you know, we've talked about, is just the idea, as Jackie was saying, the Republicans, you know, Paul Ryan went out and said, attacked, you know, President Obama for cutting $716 billion out of Medicare. Paul Ryan had it in his budget. The same money. He was going to repeal the entire health law but leave the $716 billion. That's not a matter of not true. That's just a matter of hypocrisy. So there's different things about it. But, you know, a lot of it is, some of it is being done, but some of it, as Drew says, with the death panels, that's simply difficult. It's difficult to explain, you know, David's 800 words. It's very difficult to explain in my form, and it's on the radio. It just, the world is what the world is.
Well, we have reached that time on behalf of deers and monkeys and Miles Davis. And the American people. I want to thank everyone on the panel and the other panel and all of you especially for coming. And we'll see you for the next time we do this. Thanks very much.